If you're a church leader, you know that volunteers are busy. They're always on the go. So trying to get them into a room for training is next to impossible. The brand new version of Ministry Grid gives you the ability to meet your people where they are and train anyone, anywhere, at any time. With a new mobile-friendly design, Ministry Grid puts training in the pockets of those who need it, wherever they are and whenever it's convenient for them. Ministry Grid also offers 750 courses for every role in your church so that you can use it right out of the box or customize it by adding your own content to complement what we have already put together. To get started for free, just go to ministrygrid.com. Once again, that's ministrygrid.com. Now, enjoy our podcast. You're listening to the Five Leadership Questions podcast. I'm your host, Todd Adkins, and I'm here today with Eric Geiger.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
As well as Dr. Gene Twenge. You may or may not have seen her on, the first place I saw you was actually on Facebook on, it was a CBS, I think it was the Today Show or Good Morning America one, but it was a fascinating 3 minutes of television, which caused me to look at the book. And then more recently, Eric was reading the book and that caused me to go back and actually buy the book because we compete with each other on reading most of the time. If I hear he's reading something, I'm going to read it.
Yeah, he actually asked my assistant. He tries to cheat and get my assistant to tell him all the books that I'm reading so he can be ahead. But let's do a little more introduction of Dr. Twenge. So she's a professor of psychology at San Diego State University, whose running back just, I think, broke Marshall Faulk's running back. Are you into sports at all?
Nope.
All right.
Me either. I'm in good company finally.
Yeah, that's right. Todd is not in sports either. Well, you had a really good running back at your school. So professor of psychology, but also the author of a good number of books similar to in the genre of iGen. The book that I have most recently recommended the most to people is the book iGen. And so I, after reading it about halfway through, I tweeted a picture of it saying, if you're in kids ministry or work with children or teenagers in a school system like my wife does, this is a must read. And a bunch of people favored it. And I had people respond, oh, absolutely, this is a must read. So people who were ahead of the game. Then I actually wrote several articles about it. The book really was impactful to me as someone who thinks a lot about this, serving this generation through what we do in our roles at Lifeway. But also, I mean, most important for me is I'm a parent of two kids that are in the middle of this generation. So one 10 and one 8. And you would say that iGen, and you say that some other people give different dates, but I believe you said from anywhere from 1995 to 15 to 17 years after. Is that how you would phrase the generation?
Yeah, so the 1995 is pretty clear that's the first birth year for iGen. They're the first they're the first generation to spend their entire adolescence with smartphones. And the internet was commercialized in 1995. So they're also the first generation who can't even remember a time before the internet. And when that generation ends, is anybody's guess, but generations these days are often 15, 16 or so years. So I put the end at 2012, but that number could be revised later.
And some other titles that I've heard ascribed to that generation would be Generation Z, which I believe you say, Generation Y didn't stick, so let's not go with Z. Or is there any other titles that are sometimes given to this generation?
Some people just say post-millennials, but that never works. It never works to name a generation after the one before, which is yet another reason why I don't think Gen Z is going to stick. That was based on millennials being called Gen Y, but nobody calls them Gen Y anymore. So I can't see Gen Z sticking. So we'll see. We'll see what sticks. The case I make for iGen is that it's based around smartphones, which have really shaped their lives and kind of had ripple effects through many areas of their lives.
What I find fascinating is, we're
the three of us are all Xers, and that your first book, Generation Me, you actually started writing when you were like 22 years old. So, you know, one of the questions we always ask is, you know, what would you tell your 20-year-old self? So, it's interesting to me what you would now say, you know, looking back, on that first book, what are some of the most significant differences between millennials and iGen? Because a lot of people, you know, are really studying millennials at the moment, but what do they need to be looking for, you know, for what's next?
Yeah, there's a pretty sharp generational break between millennials and iGen. One that's much more pronounced than the break between, for example, Gen X and millennials, where it was more of a kind of a natural progression. With iGen, a lot of the trends that had been going on since the boomers started to reverse. So, for example, teens' happiness and life satisfaction was rising from the early 90s through about 2011 or 2012. Then it fell. Right around that same time, more teens started to say that they felt useless, that they felt like they couldn't do anything right. Those are classic symptoms of depression. The rate of major depressive disorder, so very serious type of depression, started to increase right around that time as well. Even sadly, the suicide rate among teens really started to rise after about 2010. So there's all these indications that you have millennials who are this very optimistic, positive, relatively happy generation. And then it all kind of falls apart with the transition to iGen, who unfortunately are saying, you know, in these big national surveys that I work with, they're saying much more likely to say, I'm not satisfied with my life. I'm not happy. I have these symptoms, which are symptoms of depression.
Yeah, I mean, when I looked at the research, it's very sad. You see, they're sleeping less, they're less mentally healthy, less happy, and with it being called iGeneration, the book, and also what I believe with the name that will stick to the generation, how much of that's directly and indirectly connected to the smartphone?
So that's always the harder question to answer in. You know, research like this where you're looking at cultural change. So the gold standard when you do science is to do an experiment. Well, you can't do an experiment with generations. You can't say you're going to be in this generation and you're going to be in this one and then let's see what happens. It doesn't work that way. So you have to try to find evidence where you can get it. And in this case, like, there's two major pieces of why I think the smartphone is at the root of a lot of these issues around unhappiness and depression for iGen. So the first is the time sequence of the adoption of smartphones and these mental health issues lines up very closely, and hardly anything else does. So with that big change around 2011 or 2012, well, 2012 was the year when the percentage of Americans with a smartphone crossed 50%. It was that time, say 2012 to 2015, that 3-year period is when most of that change happened. That was a time when the U.S. economy was improving.
Right.
So it doesn't seem like it's economic issues. If it were other economic issues around, say, income inequality or changes in the job market, those have been going on since the 80s, if not before. So if that's what was driving it, you would have thought these issues would have showed up, you know, longer ago. And some of them did, but then they kind of stopped. They, you know, were really kind of flat for a lot of the 2000s before they then really, really spiked upward in a kind of sudden way. So the time sequence really lines up. And it makes sense because more teens getting smartphones, spending more time online and on social media, that was by far the biggest change in teens' lives between 2012 and 2015. Them getting smartphones and then everything that follows from that, like not seeing your friends in person as much, not sleeping enough. So that's the first thing, is that time sequence lines up. Then the second piece is, sure enough, teens who spend more time online and on social media and on their phones are less happy. and more likely to be depressed.
And that when I see the data in the book, and one of the reasons I recommend is it's a great blend of both quantitative and qualitative. And so there's interviews with people in, you know, kids and teenagers in iGeneration, and then there's the hard data. So it's a great mix of those two. And so as I read the book, I'm thinking, gosh, I'm looking back when I was in middle school and high school, and some years the yearbook day was a great day because I'd open the yearbook and there'd be some pictures in me in the back, you know, and not your class, but just random photos. And oh, I made a photo, and it's one that I'm.
You look for how many page numbers you were on.
Yeah, right.
And I'm not embarrassed. Same here.
I'm not embarrassed by that photo. And then there were some years where that wasn't a good experience. I'd look through and I'd see some of my friends and I wasn't in that picture. And so does that mean I'm not perceived now as really being in with that group? And so I can imagine, well, I really can't imagine, but when you think about Instagram, you actually say that of any of them, you would prefer Snapchat because the image goes away quickly. But so on Instagram, a Twitter, Facebook, kids are seeing that emotion that I felt on yearbook day. They live with that every single moment. Is that the kind of emotional responses or trauma is probably too hard of a word or pressure that you felt when you interviewed people in that generation?
Yeah, a lot of them talked about that, about how it was stressful waiting for the likes to show up on the Instagram post, of how stressful it is to wait for, you know, that response back on social media or that text back from a friend. And if you don't hear from them, does that mean they don't like you anymore? You know, the other thing about social media, just as you mentioned, is that it's just so constant and it's right there and it's immediate. So it's just one example. You know, if you're in high school and you didn't get invited to the party with the cool kids over the weekend,
yep.
Used to be you'd hear the whispers of that in the hallway on Monday morning. Now you see the pictures right away in real time when you're home by yourself on Saturday night.
Yeah, it's painful. So what Todd asked this earlier, and I thought this was fascinating from the research. I know we're bouncing all over the place, but just some of the great thoughts from the book are coming to my head. Is Todd, you asked about the difference between millennials and iGen. So we would celebrate often in ministry. So a lot of people who are listening are church leaders that, hey, millennials are altruistic. They want to be a part of a cause. They're mission centric. The research actually says that iGen has taken a step back in that, correct? That they are less focused on, in intrinsic motivation.
Yeah. You know, it's a little bit of a mixed picture. So there's actually some good news when it comes to altruism that had been sliding. So the importance of helping other people and so on, that had been sliding for a while in the transition between boomers and Gen X and millennials. And then it's actually ticked up a little bit with iGen. So in some ways they talk the talk. I think the problem is they don't always walk the walk. Mm. So if you look at, say, charity donations, those have, you know, actually went up during the recession and then have come back down. And overall, there is that shift, as you mentioned, away from the intrinsic values like family and community and helping others toward the more extrinsic values of materialism and fame and image and so on. Some of that peaked with the millennials because they had more of that generational personality of optimism and wanting to get attention and being out there. So iGen's dialed that back, you know, to an extent, but they have kept some pieces of it, like the materialism, like entering college students, you know, are still, I think it's 82% say that it's important to become, quote, very well off financially.
Right, right.
And that's at an all time high.
Yeah, I saw that. I thought that was fascinating. And one of the things you mentioned in the book, and I wanted to try to understand this a little better, is the optimism that we saw in the millennials. You joked in the book that during interviews, hey, what do you want to do in 5 years? I want to be the CEO of the company. That the optimism of the millennial generation isn't what we're seeing in iGen. How is the phone impacting that? Is it because they're seeing things? Well, what's causing optimism to wane?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think some of it is their experience with the recession, that they experienced the Great Recession as children. So it may have changed their worldview a little bit more than the millennials who, you know, bore the brunt of it as young adults, but had, you know, already kind of formed how they viewed the world. But I think the smartphone has something to do with it as well, especially social media, because we have a tendency, anybody's on social media, you compare yourself to everybody else's more glamorous life. And that's because people are only featuring the good things on right. Facebook and not all the bad things. So there's that element to it. And then part of it is just this general unhappiness and depression that has really appeared among iGen. And there's this weird thing that happens with people when they are unhappy and when they're depressed. They start to think more negatively and less optimistically. You know, it's like instead of wearing rose-tinted glasses, when you're optimistic and you're happy, like they put on blue-tinted glasses and like nothing looks as positive anymore. And the future doesn't look as bright anymore. So that's probably part of what's going on there.
Okay. And because we have a lot of church leaders that listen to this, I wanted to point out one of the things mentioned in the book is, and this compares to, I believe you were comparing this to millennials and previous generations, that we sometimes would say, hey, a generation, they're not into organized religion. They're not religious, but they're still spiritual. And, mm-hmm. and the research is saying with iGen that they are simultaneously less religious and less spiritual. That is that what you found in both the qualitative and the quantitative?
Yeah, exactly. So that's been a subject of a lot of discussion for a while. So first there was the argument, okay, well, people aren't affiliating with a religion as much, but they're still going to services. Then that turned out not to be true. So, you know, attendance at services started to drop as well. Then the argument for a while was, okay, there's not as much public involvement in religion, like going to services or affiliating, especially among young people in their 20s and in their teens, but they still believe. They are still just as likely to believe in God and to pray. Turns out that's not true anymore either. In the last 10 years, especially the last 5 to 7 years, that's really changed too. So you look at both teens and young adults, many fewer now say that they're a religious person. Fewer say that they pray or believe in God. There's about 1 out of 4 now among young adults who say they never pray and they don't believe in God. And that's a big shift, because it used to be close to everybody who said that they prayed at least sometimes and that they believed in God. And then the last kind of argument standing was, okay, but they're less religious, but they're more spiritual. Well, that doesn't turn out to be true either. In one of the surveys, the trend among young people in being a spiritual person is fairly stable and trending a little bit downward. And then in another survey of entering college students, they're asked if they think they're above average in spirituality, and that has declined pretty steadily over time. So all of these things have fallen. And so what you really end up with is the majority of young people are still religious and still interested in religion, but there's a much larger minority who are not, and are not interested at all, are not religious, are not spiritual, don't pray, don't believe in God. Around 1 out of 4 of young adults are now in that category.
Okay. Yeah, that's definitely a shift. So one of the things that I thought was fascinating, and I'm going to quote you from the end of the book, which I was telling you when we first got on the call, I think this is before we hit the record button, how grateful I am for your book. It came at a great time for my wife and I. We have 10-year-old and 8-year-old, and hey, daddy, can I get a phone? When can I get a phone are becoming common questions that they ask. And you wrote this, and I thought this was pretty fascinating. After multiple years of researching this generation, this to me seemed to be, because it was at the end, you know, I've written and you tend to sum up some key thoughts. And so I don't know if you would say this is a main takeaway, but for you, it for me, when I was reading the book, I thought, okay, this is, you know, one of the capstone statements from everything. You wrote, it is best to put off giving your child a cell phone as long as possible. There's really no reason for an elementary child to have his own cell phone. So that's an easy one. By middle school, with kids in more activities and more likely to ride a bus, many parents buy phones for convenience and safety. However, that phone does not need to be a smartphone complete with internet access and the ability to text. And so that was a very helpful, you know, the person who's researched this for years to give that type of clarity on what your recommendation is. Is that how, I think you mentioned that's how you're approaching your home?
It is. Yeah. So my husband and I have three children. They're all girls, as it turns out. They're 11, 8, and 6. So my oldest is in fifth grade, so at the end of elementary school. So she tells me she's the only one in her class who doesn't have a smartphone. But the average age in this country to get a smartphone, your first smartphone is now 10. Oh. That's, according to some surveys. So that makes me think that might actually be true. Yeah. So I think, you know, it will come up again when she starts middle school in the fall. But what, ideally what I'd like to do is to put off getting her a smartphone until high school, until she's 14. So ninth grade. And the idea there is, sure, okay, maybe we'll get Gizmo a watch or a flip phone if we feel like she needs it for taking the bus and other things that might be convenient. But I don't want to hand her a device, especially, you know, unregulated, that she can go on social media and play games as much as she wants. And, you know, that she's going to try to sneak into her room at night and stay up all night, which is what a lot of teens do. And that compromises sleep. So, you know, when and if we do get that smartphone for her and our other children, I think it would be very, very locked down. I would, whatever app or other technology I can find to shut that thing down at night, to, let her use certain apps only for a short amount of time, to only use the phone for a certain number of hours a day. Even in ninth grade, when mm-hmm. you know, she might get that smartphone, I'm going to put lots of regulations on it, because these technologies are addictive. I mean, social media in particular, but the phone in general is addictive, and kids and teens just don't have as much self-control as adults do. And you see adults and how addicted we are to these devices.
Oh, absolutely.
And then you put that in the hands of a kid who doesn't have as much self-control. Not to mention they don't have their sense of identity is developing, especially in middle school. It's just not a good combination.
I've remained quiet and let Eric ask all the questions. And I cannot be quiet anymore. My question really involves, this is a leadership podcast. Most of the people that listen to it are, you know, as Eric said, church leaders or business leaders. And so, you know, if we're talking about the generation, the people that were born in 1995 are now hopefully graduating college and entering the workforce. And we're going to be leading these people very, very soon. How, just from, I don't know if you've done any research in particular on leading this generation, but how would we lead them well? What do we need to, you know, a good leader knows where to push you and stretch you, but also, you know, knows where not to, that we might, you know, break you if we push too much into one area versus another. So how would we lead iGen well?
Yeah. So chapter 7 in the book is about iGen's attitudes toward work and different workplaces and the type of jobs that they'd like to have and not like to have and their work ethic and so on. You know, so what I'll start with is there's a lot of really good news in that chapter for managers, because the flip side of iGen having some of these issues around unhappiness and depression is they also don't have the narcissism and entitlement that a lot of millennials displayed of the, you know, I'm going to be the CEO of the company in 5 years. So their expectations are more reasonable. So it's not good that they have these mental health issues, but it has, you know, meant a return to earth for some expectations, which can be useful for everybody, including them, if they're a little more realistic. So they also have a stronger work ethic. They're more willing to work overtime. They're more likely to say they think work is going to be a central part of their lives, even compared to young people just, you know, 5 years ago. So there's a little bit of a shift there. Very practical in terms of the types of jobs that they want and the industries that they want to go into. And contrary to what many would think, they are actually less interested in owning their own business or being an entrepreneur compared to, say, Gen X in particular, which was very interested in that. Because there's been a common perception, you know, in corporations, many managers are like, well, wait, they're all going to try to found their own internet business. But perhaps because iGen is so practical and was shaped so much kind of in the crucible of the Great Recession, they are not interested in that. It's too risky. They're a very risk-averse generation. So, you know, if you're somebody looking to hire young college graduates, this is a great opportunity to hire a generation that has a good work ethic, more realistic expectations, and is, looking for a nice, stable career. So, when you think about how you work with your employees, a lot of times millennials really needed praise almost for self-admiration because they expected it. iGen needs praise because they really need to be built up more. I talked about, you know, depression going up and happiness going down. The other thing that really happened right around 2012 for teens is their self-esteem plunged. So this is just a group that is much less confident, and they are coming into the workplace without as much confidence in themselves and their abilities. So you do have to be careful in how much you push them, because there is a sensitivity there. And that, and I don't mean that as a criticism. It's just a reality that this generation is just a little more uncertain of themselves. And so, you know, they're a little more fragile. They need to be handled with more care. But if that can be done, they are definitely willing to work hard.
That's encouraging. I'm glad for us to end on an encouraging note. And I found the whole book encouraging because of the clarity it provides. And when you think about iGeneration and the phone, this is not, when we talk about, hey, hold off on having a phone, it's not like the former generation. You know, my parents were warned about the dangers of rock and roll music and the backward masking because I would hear some crazy things. This isn't that. The warning that I found in the book, it wasn't because they'd come across a certain type of content. It's because how the phone teaches them to think and long for likes and deteriorates their self-esteem and their sleep and their reading and all of those things. So am I summing that up correctly?
Yeah. That, you know, there's often two worries when it comes to media. One is content and the other is access and time. So there are certainly worries about content, but those are things that, you know, most parents are familiar with,
right?
In terms of restricting content and what kids see online. But the amount of time spent is also an issue that the teens who are spending, say, 5 or more hours a day on electronic devices are at a much higher risk for depression and unhappiness and even risk factors for suicide, like depression or even having attempted suicide before. So, and you look at it that way, it's not just, oh, they're doing something that's safe. Well, if they're on that phone that many hours a day, then that is going to have some consequences for happiness and mental health. Even if it's just because if they're doing that, then they're not doing these things that are much more likely to lead to happiness, like seeing friends in person or sleeping.
All right, that's good. Well, I want to recommend to everyone who's listening, Todd, we'll have in the show notes links to the book, correct?
Yes, for sure.
It's an excellent read. If you're a parent of this generation, for sure read it. If you work with teenagers, if you work with kids school, local church, any kind of not-for-profit or ministry setting. I believe this is an absolutely important read, and I'm grateful for all. I know it took a ton of time, not just to write it, but a lot of research that went into the book. So thanks for your work.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.